Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags, bringing you 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live, and then you can catch us later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, delivering all the essential updates you need fast and focused. It's Friday, the 6th of September. On the program today, could John Steenhuisen's decision to hire right-wing podcaster Roman Kabanak put the future of the government of national unity at risk? Why eyes and ears are still the most at risk in many workplaces? A financial regulator's plans to require financial institutions to play open cards about their spend on financial education? And a new survey reveals why South African youth has deep concern over corruption, joblessness and slow progress post-apartheid. Politics at the end of the day is all about optics and the people you surround yourself with. And to that end, serious questions are being asked about DA leader John Steenhuisen and his decision to appoint Roman Kabanak as his chief of staff in the Agriculture Ministry. Imran Bakas is a political analyst and says it is a staggering error of judgment. He joins me on the program now. And Imran, first of all then, how does the appointment reflect the DA's broader political strategy, in your opinion, and I guess the messaging?
I think firstly, let me just lay out some context. Johnny Steinberg writes really elegantly in the Business Day this morning. And one of the key points he makes is, how in the context of the aura of liberation wearing off, we'd like race groups to be voting not typically for parties that they voted for. But in the last election, we know 8 or 9 out of 10 people, black people, went towards the ANC or offshoots of the ANC. And that was the same case for white people in relation to the DA. Now, I think that's really warring 30 years into democracy. And the appointment of Roman Kabanak by Steenhuisen and the DA, doesn't help that cause at all. I think it leaves a permanent stain on the reputation of Steenhuisen and of the party. You know, we don't need to go over what he said. I think that's been well ventilated in the national conversation. His comments about Bantu and Arab people and his comments about Black Lives Matter and Sharpeville, etc. But I think what's also really worrying is the extent to which this places strain on the GNU and the kind of ammunition that it offers for ethno-nationalists, if you like, the EFF, MK, and perhaps even other party. I would contend that GNU is far from perfect, but it's, a political outfit, a machination that many of us want to work. And I think the actions taken by someone like Steenhuisen certainly doesn't help that.
So if we have what potentially could be mistrust within the GNU as a result of this appointment, the short-term implications could in fact be very risky.
Yeah, absolutely risky. I think, it has been argued that the GNU can't continue to claim that it's an alliance of constitutionalists while it has people like Gaetan McKenzie, a far right-wing xenophobic populist. And it now can be argued the same is true of someone like Steenhuisen, who sees nothing wrong with appointing an openly racist far right-wing figure to a really senior position in government. And it's not like this position is in dire need of some rare skill that that Kabanak brings, And what's even more worrying in our national politics, Jeremy, is I think there's a dramatic move to narrow nationalisms. We come from a dark history of the African National Congress trying to build this embracing African nationalism. But then we've had insular nationalism, like the English nationalism, the Afrikaner nationalism, and no doubt Zulu nationalism. Many of us thought that, you know, that was buried in the past. But we're now seeing an increase or a rise of new forms of ethnic nationalisms, like the Patriotic Alliance. You know, its appeal to the colored vote is an insular nationalism. As much as Zuma and MK deny that they have, you know, there's a strong current of Zulu nationalism, there certainly is, and perhaps in other parties too. And I would, you know, say the DA is treading on dangerous ground here as it continues to make the kinds and types of mistakes that it does.
Do you think that John Steenhuisen's defense of Kabarnak signals a shift in the DA values, or is this simply one man's hubris?
Well, I don't think it's one man. I think, you know, the DA has generally, you know, gone in this direction. We've even seen Helen Ziller make a number of really controversial comments. I think the DA is also in a tough place. You know, I don't think the DA had a Musi Maimane problem. You know, I think Musi Maimane had a DA problem, that he wanted to push the DA in a particular direction, and the DA then looks to other parts of its critical electorate. And of course, that electorate does not want the DA to move in a progressive direction, if you like. I'm not sure if that's the right word. But so, in that context, I think the DA finds itself in a really difficult situation. But despite that, I don't think a party like the DA is going to move beyond 20-25% if, in a country of young people where 50% are under 30, in a country where there's a black middle class explosion that's grown from 300,000 prior to 94 to between 5 and 6 million now, depending on whose work you read. When you have a black middle class that has officially overtaken the white middle class, and if you have a strategy that doesn't seek to reach that electorate, in a country like South Africa, then I think your political future, in my view, you know, doesn't look promising at all.
Where does this leave Cyril Ramaphosa as the steward? Is he in an invidious position?
Well, you know, there's been a change and a reshaping of our politics nationally, right? So I think there's not one ANC, there's multiple ANCs, but, you know, the faction, if you like, of the ANC that Ramaphosa leads, the Social Democrats, you know, as opposed to the left or the socialist or, you know, nationalists in the ANC, see great value in having the DA as a partner, see great value in having the GNU move forward. So, and Ramaphosa has been a defender of that, you know. He's gone against the current of others wanting, even in the NEC, wanting MK or the EFF. And I think the balance of forces is certainly in Ramaphosa's court. But I think increasingly, if the DA continues to make decisions like it has, it's going to make that a really difficult position to defend.
Having said that, though, we all know that a week is a long time in politics, and given the backlash then, do you think there is pressure on Steenhuisen to either retract the appointment or even step down, or could he tough it up?
Well, I think if the DA and Steenhuisen wants to pull back from this kind of permanent destruction of its prospect to not only win back the black vote, but to be seen as a serious political contender even among decent white people, it'll need to act really fast to resolve this, the house fiasco. And if it doesn't, I think, you know, I know Steenhuisen, he's a nice person, but the kind of political decisions he's making leave much to be desired. And I think, you know, if he is going to continue in this direction, then the DA would do well to remove someone like Steenhuisen. And, you know, I think if it does not act decisively in the face of this, it could face an implosion. And it really poses, and this is a huge concern for me and I'm sure many other people, the sort of risk it poses to the viability of the GNU. And it tends to make the EFF and even MK look credible, or more credible in the eyes of many people.
I'm going to leave it there, Imran Bakkes. Thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Well, from party politics, let's move to occupational safety now. And the Occupational Health and Safety Act requires or ensures the rights of all employees to work in a safe environment. And while improvements have been made through technology and, I guess, automation, South Africa's mining and industrial sectors still rely heavily on manual practice, and obviously that can put workers in harm's way. Let me explore this in a little more detail. Dr. Jessica Hutchins is with us, Head of Prevention at Rand Mutual Assurance, and she says they are seeing recurring injuries and illnesses in these sectors. And Dr. Hutchins, this is concerning. We live in an era of compliance. What's the problem here? Do you think that rules are just being flouted?
Hi, Jeremy, and good afternoon to everyone. It's not so much about rules being flouted. I think it's the, you know, there's a lack of seriousness towards this particular area in business. And I think, you know, with competing socioeconomic and social political strains, we find that there hasn't been the necessary investment in terms of employee health and safety. And I think that is what we are seeing from industry, is the need to kind of go back and reinvest to prevent harm to the employees. It has a domino effect in terms of employees, numbers, loss of life, injuries, occupational diseases, but also impacts on the bottom line for companies as well.
So where does the investment need to be focused?
So I think we're seeing, as you mentioned in the introduction, you know, reoccurrence and still a high number of injuries, in particularly, you know, fatalities increasing in the mining sector, where there's been a lot of investment in health and safety. In the metals and construction industry, you know, we see quite a significant number of fatals. So the investment really needs to be about, I think, a lot of education and awareness around the rights and responsibilities of employees, but also the duties of the employer, and that, you know, health and safety is not just for the employers to do, but the employees and how they present themselves. I think certainly the mining sector has advanced, as you said, in technology and automation, but we find your construction and your metal sector, automotive, still grappling with that. But also just in terms of, you know, the need for enforcement from you know, the government, Department of Labor, DMRE as well. So this is a systemic challenge for all of us, but we need to act as a collective rather than in silos.
So you talk about government stepping up, which I guess begs the question about how effective current regulatory measures are in mitigating the risks of accident. I assume if we're seeing more injuries and illness, it's not particularly good. So what mitigatory steps need to be taken?
I think, as I mentioned, we need to work together. So there's the employer, there's the employees, there's obviously, like ourselves, a compensation insurer, there's the government as well. And I think there's a real need for everyone to come together with the institutional knowledge, the expertise. This is actually happening on the 16th of October, where, as part of the Department of Employment and Labour's new minister in office, 100 days, we are signing an accord, a health and safety accord, as all the various stakeholders, including a very important stakeholder, which is the unions, reaffirming everyone's commitment to the importance of health and safety. And so that's one thing that needs to happen. Also in terms of further educating the sort of management of what their responsibilities and duties are, ensuring that employees have the right personal protective equipment, that machinery is maintained according to standards, ensuring that there's, you know, also things such as the element of wellness being brought into health and safety. So it really needs to be tackled by a collective, but I'm really hoping that this recommitment by the Department of Employment and Labour on the 16th of October will sort of set us in the right path.
I fully understand the collegial and collective approach that you're advocating, but patently it's not working well right now given the increase. So surely we also need to consider a more punitive approach.
Yeah, so it's a tricky one, right? You know, carrot and stick approach sometimes works, but I think you know, you mentioned compliance. You can go through a red traffic light and there's no necessary consequence, right? You can commit crime and we see how long it takes for the courts to bring in things. So I think this is a greater systemic issue for the country. There is a need to you know, lead by example and set the record straight. So in the event that employees are losing their lives, getting injured, what are the consequences? But I think in terms of the country that we live in, we often don't see those consequences happening quicker or materializing at all. So yes, there is a need for better enforcement. And, you know, as for example, where I am at Rand Mutual, we're working together with the Department of Employment and Labour Inspectorate to better upskill and equip the inspectorate. We're also hosting 4 conferences, actually, funny enough, this month, starting in Gqeberha and Durban, Joburg and Mbombela, to really bring the community together, but to start asking the questions, what can we do better? We're having these recent incidents such as the George collapse. We're seeing fatalities. We're seeing repeat accidents. What more can the industry do over and above what it is currently doing?
Of course, you've got to make sure the industry has an appetite for that. And one would assume, given the current situation right now, that is going to be a tough ore to pull.
Yeah, I mean, I firmly believe people don't come to work, you know, to kill themselves or to harm themselves. And, you know, employers always say that their most prized asset or valued asset are the people. So I think it's a matter of balancing productivity and health and safety. And often when you are speaking to senior management, they do see it as an additional expense, you know, the money that they don't have when they're trying to just run their business, countering load shedding and having enough money to put into diesel to keep their businesses going. But I think it's, again, when you're doing the cost benefit of investing in health and safety, it not only makes business sense, but is a moral and ethical way of how we should be running our businesses. So that narrative really needs to come through in many business decisions. The consequences, I know someone always says, you think compliance is expensive, you know, try non-compliance. And I think people need to realize that if they don't have healthy and safe workers or a workplace, the impact that that will have for them going forward in terms of their business and productivity.
And that's a very powerful punctuation point to this conversation. Dr. Jessica Hutchings, thank you very much indeed. At Rand Mutual Assurance, she is the head of prevention.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Attention, all investors and finance enthusiasts. Get ready for the annual Money Summit, Africa's largest and most influential savings and investment event. Join me, Jeremy Maggs, on Tuesday, the 10th of September at the Sandton Convention Centre as we connect with over 100 top chief executives and industry leaders across 20 exciting conferences and forums, all in one incredible day. Secure your spot now. Register online at www.moneysummit.co.za for free with the code MoneyWebGuest. This is your chance to be part of Africa's premier savings and investment event. Don't miss it.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday.
South Africa's debt crisis has been widely reported on, with the finance minister cautioning consumers to tighten their belts. And in this vein, the Financial Sector Conduct Authority's new Financial Education Commitment Charter is calling on financial institutions to now play open cards about how much they are actually allocating towards financial education. I'm with Alicia Moses now, Senior Consumer Education Specialist. And first of all, what then, and welcome to you, what do we mean by open cards?
I think when it comes to the open card statement, it's not so much the money, but it's more the intention behind the intervention. So when entities and companies are doing consumer financial education, are you really doing it with the pure intention of just delivering financial education to consumers, with the end result being a financially informed consumer? Or are you just ticking a box? Are you just doing compliance? And a lot of these entities, they almost have they sneak in marketing. So as much as I'm providing you with education on an insurance product or insurance in general, I'm also pushing my own agenda to get some leads and sales based on that.
So what specific guidelines then should the Financial Education Commitment Charter impose?
So the Financial Education Charter is one of our thought leadership ideas and projects. And last week at our Financial Education Summit, we proposed as the FSCA 5 commitments for CEOs and MDs and heads of organizations, specifically in the financial services industry, to buy into. And these 5 commitments are trying to achieve the goal of a financial literate nation, but we believe that it must be a collaborative approach. And I think I'll just mention the commitments lightly to you without further explanation. Mm. The one commitment is we would love companies to adopt a financial education plan that is board approved and published. That means that they will then eventually will commit and do and complete. The FSCA has an example of its own financial education plan. So what will it be doing? The second commitment speaks to delivering targeted financial awareness and financial education programs, but in line with this plan. The third one is to deliver financial education in line with best practice norms and standards, because we want quality, we want impact, we want reach, we want behavior change, and obviously I said now no marketing. A commitment four would be to strive to increase the impact of our financial education programs through suitable resourcing, strategic partnerships, and digitizations. We realize that financial education programs and so forth are expensive, and thereby collaborating, bringing entities together and unifying our efforts, we can do a better job. Mm. And then the last commitment is to prioritize financial wellness of our customers, but in a very demonstrated way.
Do you think, Alicia, it's the cost that puts financial institutions on the back foot here?
I don't think lately with the inclusion of digital, it doesn't have to cost a lot of money to do quality financial education. You can start at home, and at home meaning your own employees. You can start financial wellness programs within your organization and gorge the financial literacy levels, gorge the perceptions, the insights. Remember, a lot of these companies, they've got insights available, readily available on their consumer behavior. They know that Alicia, for example, living in Pretoria, Montana, pays her insurance policy. And I'd rather sell a product to Alicia in Montana than Mariki in another place, because in that area, they're known for policies lapsing. They've got these statistics available. They also have statistics available on consumer behavior. Are people saving? Are people budgeting? Are people thinking about the future? Two parts has just been issued out. Are people in panic or are they parting? And I believe that you must start, if you want to start, start, but start small. Mm. If you want, start at home. If your own staff are educated, then they can take that education, because they are consumer facing. They see consumers every day, they interact with them, and it will be great if they can convey that through that kind of train the trainer approach.
And Alicia, how do you counter the argument from financial institutions who might say a lot of that data or information is proprietary?
I know this is a tricky one. You know, one of the aims of this summit that we had is where we wanted to create a central repository for information sharing, data, research. And you know, it's tricky. They don't want to share that. It's a competitive space sometimes. But I think if you look at the end goal of the, because an informed consumer also buys insurance products. Think about it as a two-approach thing. If I don't know and I buy an insurance product and then I default, versus I have been informed, educated, I buy an insurance product, I most likely will keep that insurance product. So it's in their best interest to develop that trust, but also, as I say, pure consumer financial education without wanting sales, but at the same time also just building a financial literate nation that knows how to respond to certain hardships as we've experienced in our country.
What's the response been like so far?
When we initially presented the charter to the CEOs and MDs, they were very keen. They were keen because everybody has been doing a little bit of something on consumer education, but without commitment. It's just a nice to do or in line with requirements from the financial sector code. But what this basically does is it brings things together. It brings things together. It brings it home. It makes me, as the CEO of a company, commit and say, I'm going to do this, and actually almost be obliged now, because you've committed, you've signed this charter, to say that I'm actually going to do something in line with this. And then next year summit, we want feedback. What did you guys do? How did you achieve? What were your challenges? How did you go about solving these challenges? If you don't have the answer, let's try and solve it together.
To what extent do you think customers should be putting pressure on financial institutions to provide them with that information?
This is the big problem in South Africa, is that our consumers themselves don't know their rights and responsibilities. They don't know what they could be asking. They don't know their recourse or the complaints process to follow when they are complaining, or they just give up too easily. And I think our consumers need to understand that at the end of the day, there is a very strong financial industry out there. There are many entities at play, and that you, as a consumer, do have a choice to participate and to inform yourself and educate yourself, make informed decisions, and before you even get into trouble. I think the trick here is that we want consumer education from nursery school right throughout your life cycle, and not just when you are in trouble or in debt or feeling burdened or financially stressed or have just lost a job and don't know what to do.
Alicia Moses, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally on the program today, a new study on the country's younger cohort reveals continuing concern over corruption and lack of work. Well, I guess no real surprise there. More now from Ivor Ishikovitz, who's the founder and chairman of the Ishikovitz Family Foundation that is behind the survey that funds the study, which shows that young Africans remain concerned about the direction of their countries and the continent. So, what factors do you think are driving these persistent negative perceptions, despite, as you'll tell me, some improvements?
I need to put in context the youth survey in that it's a survey that covers the whole of Africa. It doesn't just cover South Africa. So we have to see South Africa in the context of the rest of the continent. Interestingly enough, South African youth tend to be very negative about South Africa, but very positive and very optimistic about the direction of the continent as a whole. Now, one of the challenges we have is that this particular survey was done before the elections in South Africa and before the GNU came into effect in South Africa. And we plan to resurvey now that the GNU is in place. And we're hoping that we're going to see a slightly different picture. But the reality is that throughout the continent, corruption has come out as the biggest issue that African youth see as a deterrent to growth and development and prosperity. You know, in surveys historically, we've seen joblessness and the lack of availability of capital to start businesses as being the biggest concerns. But in 2024, it's corruption, corruption, corruption. And I think that not only does do the politicians need to take note, but business and civil society also needs to take note, because they're not just talking about corruption in government. They're talking about corruption in the police. They're talking about corruption in business. They're talking about corruption all over the show.
So are there specific actions, I wonder, that are necessary to effectively combat corruption and maybe restore confidence in governance? Because if you get that right, maybe the paradigm starts to shift.
Yes, absolutely. So one of the things that we talk to the respondents about is what can be done about this. And they feel that police task forces to tackle corruption in government are essential. 75% of the respondents talk about police task forces. 74% of the respondents propose extremely tough penalties for those convicted of corruption. 72% say that those convicted of corruption or where corruption is evident shouldn't be allowed to stand for public office. So absolutely, the youth are now starting to think about solutions, not just about the problem.
Notwithstanding that, job creation and economic prospect, Ivor, I would imagine, is still top of mind. Over three quarters of the youth surveyed on the continent express difficulty in finding jobs, and that issue is one top of mind in this country.
Absolutely. So in Africa generally, the youth raise joblessness as a major challenge. But the counter to that is that most of the respondents who claim that not being able to get jobs is a problem are also out there looking to start their own businesses and out there looking to create their own reality despite the fact that jobs are an issue. In South Africa, however, that isn't the trend. In South Africa, there is clearly a perception that there are no jobs out there, there are no opportunities out there. And as a result, a lot of the South African youth are looking to migrate to where opportunities do exist. We no longer are dealing with a demographic that is prepared to just sit back and take their circumstances lying down. This is now a generation that actually wants to do something about it. So in South Africa specifically, we're starting to hear young South Africans who can't get jobs saying, well, I'm going to go and migrate to places where I can. I'm going to go and look at how I can make a life for myself like any other young person anywhere in the world. If my government can't deliver to me, I'm going to find a government that does and can.
And down the line, that has a domino effect and an impact on GDP.
the impact that it has on GDP is huge. You know, Africa has the largest growing youth population in the world. This is going to give our continent the biggest consumer population in the world. These are all people who are connected to their colleagues and peers all over the world. They're no longer thinking that their Africanness is a handicap. These are people that see their Africanness as a superpower, and they're going to use it. And they're also telling us that they're going to vote with their feet. A lot of the people that we surveyed said that violent protest is acceptable if it is going to change their reality. Now, that's very concerning. A lot of the youth are starting to engage with the democratic process and are starting to see democracy as a way to change their reality. And I would suspect that what has happened in South Africa and the fact that the ANC has been punished as badly as it has is a sign of things to come in the rest of the continent.
On the flip side, though, and this was interesting, 7 in 10 young Africans are planning to start a business. That's a good thing, but they do face barriers in accessing capital. It's a universal problem. Is there any thought in terms of the survey on how this can be addressed better in order to foster that spirit of entrepreneurship?
So there is a prevailing spirit of entrepreneurship throughout the entire continent. And yes, you're right, 71% are saying that they intend to start their own businesses. Now, really interesting, you know, we ask the respondents what they would do if they were given $100. And, you know, in Europe and the United States, if you ask a young person what they're going to do with $100, it's typically going to be entertainment related, or it's going to be to go and buy a good meal or get a couple of drinks. In Africa, the bulk of the respondents would indicate that they would invest that in their business or in their education. And that, to me, is remarkable, because it indicates that there is a desire to create their own reality and not rely on government. So I think that the access to capital issue is going to be the real key in driving the African Renaissance. It's going to be the real key to driving the energy that is inherent in our youth population. Now, a lot of attempts are being made to make capital accessible. The same way as capital is accessible in the West, capital can be easily made accessible in Africa. And it now is going to be up to governments, up to donors, up to big corporations to find ways that make this capital accessible so that they can enhance and they can capture, if you like, this incredible entrepreneurial spirit that we're seeing throughout the continent.
And I'm going to leave it there. Ivor Ishikovitz, thank you very much indeed for talking to me today. And that's also our program for today. MoneyWeb at midday, live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.